Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is Now or Never. And we have Paul Venable back with us. And so thank you. Thank you again for taking this time out. I know it takes a lot to do this show myself, and for somebody that's willing to actually come in here and go toe to toe, and you know, with these documents and dialogue, and anyway, so thank you again. And your contributions,
it's worth the effort, GR.
Yeah, your contributions, I don't probably laud them enough, and thank you enough. So just let me just state that now, just so for the record, I know I fall short.
Sure.
Okay, right. So we're in the throes of the judiciary, Article 3,
okay.
And we've kind of covered the fact that their term is based on good behavior, their ability to maintain their objectivity and maintain their delegated responsibility of judging whether the contract be violated or not.
Is there somewhere where good behavior is defined? Is it possible that we covered that in ratification debates, or was that actually, or did they actually assume that everyone would understand what it meant?
Well, so I honestly think that this is something that the states need to go out and redefine this, because the states should be far more, I'll just say, they have more vested interest in getting the judiciary back into control, because obviously during the ratification debates, we went through lots of different independent debating regarding the judiciary and its ability to reign tyranny or tyranny. So anyway, go ahead and let's read Section 2. Now, we're not going to read the 11th Amendment because we'll get to that when we hit the 11th Amendment.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof, and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all the other cases before I mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
Okay.
The trial of all...
Okay.
Do you want me to stop there?
Yeah, actually, I'm sorry. Go ahead and read the rest of this, and then we'll kind of go through each chunk by chunk.
Okay. The trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. You got that highlighted. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed.
Okay.
Here we go.
All right. So let's look at where the power is extended. And so actually when you look through this, you see the semicolons. And so the semicolon is, and actually the very first line is like the overall statement.
Okay.
And every subsequent line after a semicolon, where you have this little tack, you know, the to all cases affecting ambassadors, and then
right.
to controversies, and then mm-hmm. between a state of citizens and another state, which was taken out, between citizens of different states, between citizens. So each of these is like sub bullets further defining the above. Mm-hmm. And the above being this, folks. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. But that it's right like there means that they just right? can't make any treaty.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this very specifically states that only those treaties which are within their authority. So, mm-hmm. so when we look at the treaty of the UN, and the Supreme Court actually has to intervene in a case regarding some law that has come forth out of the UN, like a refugee law, and whether mm-hmm. refugees are entitled to rights of a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And the judiciary, the Supreme Court, has granted said rights where mm-hmm. they didn't have the authority to make that treaty to allow refugees to. There's nowhere in this Constitution that allows the federal government to say we're allowing refugees to come in.
Sure.
There's nowhere where we've actually allowed that to be the sanctuary of other nations or people. I mean, it's one thing to say we have immigration laws, but immigration laws is a two-way relationship between the person who wants to immigrate and the United States.
Correct.
In other words, that person has to come to a port of entry and say, I want to become a citizen of the United States. Any person that actually comes into the United States outside of a port and or sneaks in and deliberately bypasses the immigration process is a trespasser at best. And, you know, at a bottom line, fundamentally, as the as the Constitution defines it, it's an invader.
Right.
And we now have millions and millions of invaders. And everybody is just, you know, even the mayor of New York is wanting them to, you know, slow down this.
Oh,
and they're calling it a migration crisis instead of actually saying what he should have said. Repel these invaders.
Have you heard the news?
Well.
Okay. Not just the mayor of New York.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now,
Massachusetts.
The governor of Illinois
oh, okay.
has told Biden, hey, this is too much. Well, yeah, you know, it's too much a long time ago. They're wanting to, and now I heard this. I only saw it once. I can't find it now. You know who Mayorkas is? Makes a 180, says, we have to build a border wall. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where were these people 3 years ago? Okay. And so, yeah, you know, these cities, these so-called sanctuary cities are now being overwhelmed. And they're saying, oh, no, this is too much. Well, you know, these people took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, or at least to support the Constitution. And now, you know, they are feeling the consequences of their actions. And I think, you know, if it were up to the people, they wouldn't be done feeling the consequences of their actions. But let's move on. I could get kind of animated. Right
well,
there.
So bottom line, the only thing that will actually satisfy the law,
mm-hmm.
the only thing, is if they actually repel the invaders. That's the only thing that will sure. satisfy the law. The law dictates that these invaders cannot stay. They mm-hmm. must be repelled.
Sure.
I'm not making up the law, folks, and it's not about being nice. It's about following the law. And as a matter of fact, at what point in time do we ever think that rewarding a lawbreaker is a good thing?
You would think from listening to progressives that that's the spin, GR. That's the spin. And people are buying it.
In my book, all that does is enable bad behavior. Basically, you're sending signals to malfeasance and people who are just prone to, you know, try to cut corners, break the law, or what have you. And you're just signaling to them, well, you know what? It's kind of like, we're not going to arrest you or basically even prosecute you if you shoplift less than $1,000.
Yeah.
And you've seen these videos. How many times with people filling up their cart, how many times do you think that they've actually added it all up and said, hey, you know, this is under $1,000. We're walking out of here.
Go ahead. How do you think we expect these businesses to stay in business? Well, they're not. They're moving out. Okay. What sense does it make, GR?
Well, that's a consequence. That's a consequence. But right. What I'm trying to say is many times these, you know, you give them an inch and they're going to take a mile. And many times these people are going out with more than $1,000 worth of goods.
Sure.
And it's not like the police are going to show up and go, $995. I'm sorry. We're not prosecuting this guy. Mm-hmm. And they won't even probably take the proprietors, you know, this guy's got $3,000 in his basket. You're grandizing. In other words, no. The number is arbitrary, and that really doesn't mean anything. What it means is we're not going to enforce this law.
Sure. Well, and there is that's coming. A lot of that is coming, by the way, from Soros money supported prosecutors. Where that? I mean, that may be a different subject for a different time, but. That's where that's coming from.
Right. So we got into this rat hole because of treaties which shall be made or under their authority, which are made right. or shall be made under their authority. And so my point is, folks, that the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is limited to those things arising under this Constitution, laws in pursuance to the Constitution, and treaties that are made under their authority. That is it. So in other words, when we look at let's find something that's not in their jurisdiction. Somebody that is violating land, BLM land, or, you know, environmental sanctuaries for flea grasshoppers or whatever.
Okay.
Spotted owls.
Right.
Does the federal court have any jurisdiction over those matters?
I think not.
It does not arise, not even in an appellate sense, do they have jurisdiction. So therefore, when we look at how the Supreme Court and the federal courts have aggrandized their role, they have come to a point where there is nothing that if they're willing to cross the line, they can do it, and they can do it with immunity. And they know that you dare not question them, because if you do, then they will rain tyranny upon you. You know, it's almost right. like, remember there's an adage, you know, if you want to know who you're really fighting, you know, just figure out who you can't criticize.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you really get to know, oh, okay, so it's the communists. It's the Chinese Communist Party. We can't criticize them in America anymore. We can't criticize the court anymore.
Right.
We can't criticize government anymore. And so when you want to know who your enemy is, that's what, you know, that is where we can actually find out by criticizing these folks. Now, what does this mean, though? Cases in law and equity, so law arising under this Constitution.
I was about to ask you that question. In cases in law and equity arising
so
under this Constitution.
If 34 states petition for a constitutional convention and Congress decides that, yeah, they're not going to go ahead and do that, or Congress says, okay, we're going to do this, and this is how we want it to go. What would happen? What would happen? In other words, if we're talking about a convention of states, if a convention of states actually went down, would Congress have the authority to dictate how it would go down?
Well, it's yes.
Yes. Dot, 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 yes. What?
Yes, it would, because it's within the jurisdiction of the Constitution.
It arises, so it arises underneath this Constitution.
Sure.
Okay.
So Congress can make, so the Congress that exists can make, determine how this convention would be run.
Yes, right? And they could actually invoke, they could actually invoke different standards other than those hard standards within, you know, Article 5 itself. And we'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. But the fact of the matter is, anybody that thinks that the Congress and the Supreme Court can't actually assume, because the whole point of the Convention of States is this argument to say, hey, this is the only thing we have to control them with. No, hold on. Actually, you don't. They control it. It arises under this Constitution. They have jurisdiction over it.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm trying to point out that there are things that most people, when it comes to jurisdiction, most people say, oh, well, that does, they don't have jurisdiction over that. Or they do have jurisdiction over that. And no, in both cases.
Okay.
So anyway, okay, so now they shall have the appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact with such exceptions and under such regulations as Congress shall make. So actually, let me read this back a little bit. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. Now, do they have the appellate jurisdiction of all things?
No.
No, only those things arising under this Constitution.
Sure. So, let's say that we have a state issue, and we go to the top of the state in the state's Supreme Court. It's done, isn't it? If it has nothing to do with a federal issue, just because the failing party doesn't like it doesn't mean they can go to the federal court or the Supreme Court, right?
Right. A good case in point. Let's say a state finally stands up and says, hey, this environmental land seizure that you've taken over this land, you know, we're actually going to sue the state, not the federal government, but we're going to sue the state for allowing the federal government to actually claim that land and prejudice the people of those counties, prejudice their claims over their land.
Mm.
Remember, Article 4 plays into this as well.
So in other words, instead of suing the federal government, you're saying the people would sue
the state for allowing the federal government to exercise power not granted. That is correct.
Wow.
Now, here's the question.
That puts it right where the power is.
Okay. Here's the question. Okay, so the state actually has its hands tied, and the state has to rule in favor of the Constitution and the people.
Right.
Now, if it's a real leftist state, they're going to actually violate their oath. This is where the people would then have to remove those jurists because they have violated that good behavior clause. And so going in, I would make sure that at the state level, you redefine what your good behavior of your judges is, or you know, how that is defined, and then you pursue your, you know, this case and then go after the next case, like, you know, parks and forests and so forth, and all other land that they possess or they're trying to unconstitutionally possess, Indian reservations and so forth, and then one by one, basically prove that the federal government has no authority to possess, operate, or any, you know, any cognizance over any land in that state other than for those things that are enumerated in the Constitution, such as military bases and needful buildings.
Now, so step one.
Go ahead.
Define good behavior. Step two, sue the state. Step three, hold them accountable for their response, right?
Well, so, okay, so the verdict needs, yes, if the state court does not respond in accordance with the Constitution, then they need to be removed. The judges need to be removed, anybody that's involved in that.
I don't think that's understood.
Well, they're to hold the Constitution and only the Constitution as, you know, as the measure of judging.
Wow.
Not case law. Wow. Mm-hmm. Not precedents. The Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how somebody else ruled, because that ruling may have been flagrantly wrong.
Correct.
So we actually have to look into it. And when they try to use a definition or redefine something, then you have to, you know, basically go reach in and say, you don't have the authority to redefine this. This was already defined in the ratification debates.
Okay.
That is the legal definition or the terms and definitions for this particular situation.
Right.
Okay, so once you've done that, once the state has basically made this ruling, and let's just say they finally get it right, because you may have to reappeal to the state court after the removal of the judges, and then you reappeal to the state Supreme Court, and the judges actually do what they're supposed to do. This is not fishing for an outcome. This is demanding the compliance to the Constitution, and if a few people aren't willing to do it, then they need to go. So, okay, now we go back in and we get the verdict that is constitutional. We actually, you know, get the court to finally state the obvious, that there is no enumerated power for the federal government to possess any land for environmental purposes. Boom. Then the court would then say, okay, state, go find all land that has been earmarked, flagged, or what have you, under the auspices of the Environmental Protection Agency as land being protected, you know, by the federal government. And then, you know, basically tell those, you know, basically escort those buildings, people, and equipment, the, you know, all the property belonging to the federal government, escort that out of the state and make sure that they understand that they're, you know, they have no jurisdiction here.
Okay. Whoa. Now, obviously, the state takes this stand, the feds are going to freak.
Now, when you say stand, you're not talking about a witness stand. You're actually just saying standing up against the federal government.
Yes, correct.
And the federal government is going to what? Get scared?
Push back is what I mean.
Well, so actually, what will end up happening is every other state out there that has had federal lands taken from them. And so we're going into break. So sorry about that. This snuck up on us again. But we'll pick this back up when we come back. because this is like a shot across the bow of every state when this happens. So we'll just pick this up when we come back, folks. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so thanks for hanging in there, Paul. Thanks for hanging in there, folks. So when this happens in one state, every other state that has land being seized by the federal government. And see, there are some states, like maybe Nevada, that says, you know, I kind of like this. I'm getting money for my desert. And so the federal government has been paying me to possess all this land. You're going to have a state like that that may actually want to be a stick in the mud. But you can actually start proliferating this from South Dakota to Wyoming to Montana, Washington State, Oregon, all of these states. Now, at this point in time, the makeup of these states will have to be transfigured, because Oregon and Washington and California, that are currently ruled and contained by the communist movement, who would be aghast at this kind of ruling,
right,
it would actually move a lot of people to say, hey, let's get our state back and let's get our land back. We need to get, you know, a government that's actually going to abide by and uphold these things and move this forward. Now, it doesn't mean you can't go into the state court to try to pursue this. But if you have a governor and you have a state legislature and everybody else, they're all going to figure out ways to obviate this, the facts. They're going to try to do whatever they can, and they'll come up with creative ways to say, well, we're not going to be held to that.
Okay.
Or who knows, they may actually try to invoke laws that say, okay, well, the federal government can't do that, but we'll do it. And hopefully that will then wake the people up in that state. Because bottom line, folks, we need to take our states back to do this. I mean, there are some states that can do this right now. I think South Dakota would be a prime state. Montana may be a prime state, because the judges right now have actually ruled, you know, regarding a constitutional right for a clean environment.
Did you say South Dakota or North Dakota?
Montana.
But the state before that.
Oh, the state that I think could do this is South Dakota.
Okay.
Because they actually have forest in the Black Hills that the federal government has basically said you can't harvest timber in there anymore. In other words, you know, some of this green stuff, and they've actually shut down, they've unemployed lots of people by these regulations. A sawmill or two have been shut down in South Dakota, and you know, the lumberjacks going in and harvesting the timber, all of that's gone, done. that, you know, those people that were making money to do that are now unemployed.
Right.
There you go. And
yeah, and anyone who wants to know, if they do, if you do a Google search on maps of federal land in a state like South Dakota, there's, you know, there's a, not a majority, but a significant portion that belongs to the U.S. Forest Service. Okay. And so they claim jurisdiction over this land, which could be used by the state and the people of South Dakota. Right?
That's right. That's right. So what do you do? Well, you can start by using a court case, but here's the real problem. Now, I'm just saying this because people think, oh, well, you know, we can do this. And that's where people want to do this is, oh, let's do this in the court. And the lawyers will tell you, yes, let's go into the court to do this. I'm here to tell you, folks, our court system and our legal system is so corrupt that we just can't count on it actually happening, except for maybe in one or two states that really haven't been completely sucked into the corruption. It's not that they don't have corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Corruption just hasn't taken a full lock and control. Because the Bar Association itself is a source of the corruption.
Okay.
Just so you know. And I know there's lawyers out there that tend to be good, that, you know, we like these guys. They seem to be, you know, championing, but they have constraints on. There's certain times, I mean, I've looked at the ACLJ or... ACLJ, I think is what it is. And they have constraints. They're not going to get out and fully enforce the Constitution. I've, you know, looked at patriot organizations like the Constitutional Alliance. And the court cases they go out on, they're trying to use the First Amendment right of free speech instead of the Fourth Amendment right of the right of privacy, or the right that, you know, we to be secure in our persons and our effects.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, why are you arguing that? Why are you not using the proper amendment?
Right.
And for some reason, they don't care about that part of the Constitution. I'm going, you got to be kidding me. So we have to be very clear with what we're doing and why we have to do this. Because I'll tell you, the legal system and the way the lawyers want to do things is just like political theatrics. It's how they get... you know, the law into the water, they soak it so that they make it soft under their, you know, pliable hands, and they start twisting it, and then they come back out with this twisted knot and say, here is the law, it's clear and concise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It doesn't even resemble the law.
Right.
So my point is, and we're kind of just talking about these exceptions and so forth, we can go down this path, and actually, let's look at the last one. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury.
Right.
Is that really the case?
Oh, no. Look, think January 6th. Did these people actually have jury trial? I don't even know. I know they didn't. You know, you go back, if I go back to the... Right. I don't even think there were grand juries in, you know, indicting these people. It was just the FBI rounding them up.
Well, they did form a special grand jury. They did form a special grand jury that granted itself exceptional powers. And instead of enforcing the Constitution, they enforced specifically what they were told to enforce. So in other words, they created a kangaroo court to get indictments, because there's no way a true grand jury looking at the law could find any person guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Any person guilty, because the you know, for trespassing, the Constitution clearly states that Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition government for the redress of grievances. Locking those doors violated and abridged their right to petition them. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're trying to go after people that, you know, were caught, the people that should have been actually indicted by the grand jury should have been actually Congress, every single mm-hmm. one of them. So anyway, the question, so back to this trial, how many trials has the Supreme Court ever held? Well, they have trials all the time, right? How many trials do they have? They have trials all the time. They do reviews of cases.
Right.
So do they ever have a trial by jury?
No. I don't know. The Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm.
Hang on just a minute. Let me see something here.
They are the jury.
Okay.
They are the jury. The judges are the jury. But it says, the trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crimes have been committed. Now, we're talking about appellate courts, right? And the appellate process. So, okay, so when the Supreme Court basically rules, they're basically looking and making the appeal of the case. Has there ever been a case where the Supreme Court has actually, it's gone straight from not seeing the light of day in a state court and gone straight into the Supreme Court?
Well, there should be if the Supreme Court has appellate jurisdiction, right?
No.
Original jurisdiction.
Right. So what would a case like that be? What type of case would go straight into where the federal court would have first jurisdiction?
Well, it says so. Cases affecting ambassadors, public ministers and consuls, all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, controversies to which the United States shall be a party, or controversy between two states, and, you know, skipping over the...
Okay, so but those are controversies. Let's be specific. It says right here, trial of all crimes. So it has to be a crime in the federal court jurisdiction. So in other words, there's only really two, or actually four, right? We know the crimes committed on the high seas and crimes committed against the laws of nations. That's something a little different. But
treason.
There you go.
Treason and counterfeiting.
And counterfeiting. So you could actually get, you know, an audience within the Supreme Court. How would you do that, though?
Well, someone would have to be indicted for one of those crimes, right? And that's interesting because they're crimes. They're crimes specified by the Constitution and shall be by jury. What you're saying is the Supreme Court would be a jury in a legitimate constitutional crime.
So if the Supreme Court actually was actually the venue for the first time a crime and, you know, of fact and law was being presented, then they would have to afford the criminal a jury, instead of the Supreme Court being able to rule.
Okay.
This is why the Supreme Court only operates in appellate. This is why they would move the case of treason or counterfeiting to a federal court close to the venue or the vicinity of where the crime was committed. However, I believe, because this has never come up, I believe if two states adjoin to a crime and a case, let's just say treason, let's say Black Lives Matter has been identified as a treasonous organization, and there are grand juries in several states that go after and name the national leadership as well as local leaders being a part of this grand conspiracy of treason. Let's just say that this is going, this is heading, each of these cases is individually heading into a local federal court. If you have the attorney generals of multiple states step in and say, no, we want this held, you know, into a single, we want all of these cases adjoined into a single, you know, case. I believe it would take two, if not more, but two would be, I think, the bare minimum. But that could actually drive this case into the Supreme Court. This would be the first time anything like that would have ever happened. But we have institutions that are literally committing treason. The Democratic Party. So we have institutions that are committing treason, and they're not actually being, you know, called out by the states, to where the states are adjoining and saying, we need a, you know, a full review and full trial right here, right now, to where there is there's no appeal it once you go to the Supreme Court.
See, there's the paradigm that we're trying to promote or, you know, enlighten people to is that the states have power. No one gets this quite yet, right? The states are the parties to the compact.
There you go. See, I didn't want to put any words in your mouth. That's precisely right. It is their compact. They can demand the full enforcement of this compact. When it comes to a national organization like BLM or the Democratic Party, any party that is deliberately operating to undermine this Constitution and literally executing an insurrection, it's the same thing with La Raza. There's lots of groups in America, folks, that are violating and committing treason, and nobody dares touch them.
Right.
So this they could actually... go ahead.
The people don't understand the power that we have.
There's that, and the people... I just don't think that people care. They need to start learning to care about actually seeking constitutional justice, not allowing, I'll say, the courts, lawyers, and judges to play the legal theatrics so that they can get away with twisting the law.
Right.
We have a right for this Constitution to be supported by all people in America today. You're not supporting it? Then we have the precedence of the Tory Acts. We'll just deport you. And we need to start doing that. There's way too many people getting away with treason today.
Okay.
So anyway, now we get into the Section 3. And I believe this is the jurisdiction of treason. And so
here we go. Okay. Go ahead. You ready?
Uh-huh.
All right, Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted.
Okay. Any questions?
Yes, I do have a couple of questions.
Okay.
I'd like to make sure we understand what attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture. There needs to be some clarity on what that means. I know they understood what it meant, but I think most of us today have no idea what that is.
Okay, so back in their time, they had this thing called bills of attainder. In other words, bills of death penalties. You know, you can't just have a bill that basically calls somebody to, you know, to a death penalty. Attainder means a taking of one's life. So, but no attainder of treason, no taking of the life of treason shall work corruption of blood. In other words, even though the conviction of treason is a capital offense and can, you know, persons to be hanged by that, you cannot basically create an attainder towards the family members, the corruption of blood. Okay, so in other words, in those days, you know, they wanted to make sure that the even though the husband committed treason, they couldn't just, you know, commit the whole family to treason to ensure that does that make sense?
I'll tell you why it makes sense. And this was a time when there was a great deal of biblical understanding. And I don't know if you recall this, but there were times that when someone broke the law of God and they were killed, their family was killed with them.
Okay.
And I think, and they didn't want to do that.
Now, I wasn't, I'm not aware of that actually happening in America, but
no,
it may
no.
have happened, you know, like with no. the Salem witch trials and so forth. I don't know.
Yeah, but I was just going back to, you know, Old Testament times, and, you know, this, I can't say that it happened in their time, but they apparently they wanted to make sure that this never happened. But, you know, I don't think they didn't necessarily want a theocracy. And so they didn't want, I'm guessing that they didn't want to see this type of thing happen. You know, the person who's convicted of treason is the one who pays the penalty and not anyone else.
Right, and because it goes on and says, or forfeiture, except during the life of the person attainted. In other words, the person convicted is the person that will be forfeited, their lives, their, you know, what they may possess, those types of things. But I still think that they couldn't just take family land without just compensation to the family.
Okay.
Now, that didn't exist within this article. That existed as an amendment later on.
Mm.
Right? Because the Fifth Amendment was not considered as a part of the Constitution.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So now we go into Article 4. And we got about 6 minutes left. So
we may be able to cover this.
Might be
Article
able to.
Four.
Let's go ahead and hit Section 1.
All right. Section 1. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may by general laws prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof.
Okay. Full faith and credit. In other words, you know, each state will have its own treasury, its own, you know, tracking, and kind of like, I don't want to call it a bank, but it'll have its own financial management.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you if I've got this right. If I am allowed a driver's license in Missouri, then the other states are going to accept that I have fulfilled the requirements to be a driver on their roads, for example. Right?
Right. Yep.
If I am married in Missouri, my marriage will be recognized in the other states. That type of thing.
Right.
So that's what I'm thinking of. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to public acts, records, and judicial proceedings.
Okay.
That's one of the things that comes to mind.
So,
right?
So what also comes to mind will probably be a part of the privileges and immunities, right?
Okay.
And so that comes up next.
Okay.
Section 2.
Let's go. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So, a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up, to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
Yep.
And then this is modified by the 13th Amendment, but I'll read it.
Go ahead.
No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping to another, shall in consequence of any law or regulation therein be discharged from some service, such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due.
Right.
This apparently had to do with fugitive slaves.
That is correct.
And I believe many states did not honor this.
Correct. Many of the northern states became notorious or infamous or victorious in withholding such acts of defiance against the southern states or the slave states. Correct.
Okay. And going back up to the top of Section 2, citizens of each state shall be entitled to the privileges and immunities. Here's this term, privileges and immunities. And I've heard people say that the 14th Amendment replaced rights with privileges and immunities. Then how do they explain Article 4? All right.
They don't.
What was the intention or the understanding of the framers when they used this term?
Well, so in harmony with what you read in Section 1, mm-hmm. that in Section 2, if you were granted in your state, they granted driver's licenses to a person of 14 years of age, where all bordering states granted driver's licenses to 18 years of age. Mm-hmm. The right of driving, the privileges and immunities granted by the good state of Missouri, must be recognized in all other states.
Wow. Interesting.
So when they finally got to the point, because you got to remember that the Constitution really dealt with the state governments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was this jurisdiction regarding claims with people, persons, but that was really more of an appellate case other than treason and counterfeiting. So for the most part, the United States government in Article 1, Section 8, basically created the U.S. citizen and then gave them, I'll call judicial protection with jurisdiction to ensure that no U.S. citizen that was out on the high seas could be basically charged with a crime committed on the high seas and then, be dragged into a foreign court. The whole point was that the United States had jurisdiction over those crimes and could claim jurisdiction from that other nation. They had to do that to protect all sailors or all people who were operating in the Western lands that could easily have been captured by the British and basically said, oh, you've committed a crime against the laws of nations in, being in our land. So in other words, it wasn't uncommon that foreign governments would go, have these shenanigans of trumped up charges and so forth. With that, we kind of ran out. So, Paul, just keep your questions because we didn't really clear through this. We didn't get all the way through clarification on Sections 1 and 2 of Article 4. So we'll pick this up tomorrow in our next episode. Thank you again for joining us, Paul. Folks, I hope that this is really helping you understand, how important the Constitution is. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.